There are different ways in which a person can take inventory of their physical assets or valuables. A person can look at their bank account. They can look at their investment account. If they have a garage full of antique cars, they can go in the garage and look around, or they can pull out from a safe their coin collection. In a very real way, on the first day of the week, we are participating in an inventory. And it's of the greatest values. We are being reminded that we have God and that we belong to God and that He's offered us salvation in Jesus Christ and we have the hope of eternal life. We are reminded once again of our true valuables, our true assets. And we do that together because there's another valuable that we have, and that is our brothers and sisters in Christ who encourage us in the faith. So it's so very good to be together, and we welcome those of you who have joined this assembly and this inventory of spiritual values. Thank you for being here. It is one of the most dramatic displays of God's existence and His superiority in the pages of the Bible. It is often referred to as the contest at Mount Carmel. And the main figure in the event was the prophet Elijah. And God does not want us to forget Elijah. He lives during the days of the kings of Israel after Israel had split from Judah at a very dark time, but he is proclaiming a bright light. He is mentioned at the close of the Old Testament in conjunction with the coming of the Messiah. The Savior's forerunner, John the Baptist, is depicted in the New Testament as a type of Elijah. At the Mount of Transfiguration, where Jesus' glory is demonstrated before three of his apostles, Elijah appears with Moses. James speaks in his letter in the New Testament of Elijah's powerful example of prayer. And in total, Elijah's name is mentioned 30 times in the New Testament. Elijah cast a long shadow, and he still does, even on us. We're going to look at, in 1 Kings chapter 18 and 19, this incident and the aftermath. And this man that's at the center of this powerful display of God's nature and position in the universe, this man Elijah is so human. And much like we humans, Elijah faced highs and lows. And so this morning, we're going to look at Elijah's highs and lows and think about our own highs and lows. We first turn our attention to 1 Kings, the 18th chapter. Israel was being led by an idolatrous king, a wicked man by the name of Ahab. His wife, Queen Jezebel, was even nastier in more ways than one. And because of their leadership and other factors, Israel was sinking into idolatry, and thus a famine, a drought, had been cast upon Israel, and people were suffering. And Elijah, at a very critical point in this suffering of Israel and their drought, Elijah issued a challenge to the prophets of the Baal. Baal sometimes was referred to singularly, but really it was a collection of gods, false gods that were worshipped by the people of Canaan, and the Israelites had picked up that worship and they had added to their worship of Jehovah just this collection of the Baals, and they were building idols and worshiping Baal and corrupting themselves with it. And Elijah basically said, okay, it's time for you to make a choice, either God or Baal. And so he issued to the prophets of Baal a challenge. You build an altar, you place a bull on the altar, and you call for Baal to bring fire down and consume the sacrifice. And then I'll build an altar, And I'll put a bull on it, and I'll call God to respond, Jehovah. And so they do that. And the prophets of Baal go first, and they build this altar. And they put the bull on it, and then they go around, and they're calling for Baal, and they're praying, and they're prancing about, and they're cutting themselves, and they're going through all kinds of incredible rituals to try to solicit a response of Baal. And Baal's a no-show. Embarrassingly, and Elijah goads the prophets of Baal. Where is Baal? Is he asleep? Where is Baal? Is he on a trip? And he's far gone? And nothing happens. And then toward the end of the day, Elijah takes his turn. Read with me 1 Kings chapter 18, verse 36 to 39. And at the time of the offering of the oblation, Elijah the prophet came near and said, O Lord God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known this day that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant, and that I've done these things at your word. You see, Elijah is calling upon the God who had proven himself through time, through the promises and interactions with the earlier ones and with the fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so confident he is that God will respond and show himself, that not only does he build an altar and he puts the bull on it, but he has the altar and the bull drenched with water, building a trench around the bottom of the altar and filling it, which is going to make the igniting of the sacrifice even harder. But nothing's too hard for God. In verse 37, answer me, O Lord. Answer me that this people may know that you, O Lord, are God, and that you've turned their hearts back. Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and said, The Lord, He is God. The Lord, He is God. What ensues to purge the land is that Elijah has the prophets of Baal slain. And Elijah then prays for the rains to return. And the rains come, and Israel is delivered from her drought and famine. Now, this is the kind of thing a lot of people are looking for. God, if you're God, show yourself. Do this or do that. And he does it here. But usually he doesn't. This was an exceptional demonstration of God's presence and power. As we'll see later on, God usually demonstrates it in other, more subtle ways. And one would think that if he saw fire fell from the sky and consumed a burnt sacrifice and consumed the stones that the altar was constructed of and even licked up all this water, then if you had a front seat to this like Elijah did, that you would never, ever doubt again. That you would never, ever struggle again with your faith in God. That you would never have any kind of misgiving or second thoughts or doubts at all. But look what happens. Because while Elijah finds himself on top of Mount Carmel, which was a high mountain on the coast looking out over the ocean, Mediterranean Sea, while he's literally on a high, and he's also on a high spiritually in this contest with the prophets of Baal, before you know it, he's in dark despair. In chapter 19, after Elijah and Ahab both have left the scene, word gets to Queen Jezebel, the wife of Ahab, of what happened. In chapter 19, verse 1 and 2, Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, "So may the gods do to me, and more also, if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by this time tomorrow." In other words, it's a death threat. Verse 3. Then he, Elijah, was afraid. And he arose and ran for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree, and he asked that he might die, saying, "It is enough. Now, O Lord, take away my life, for I'm no better than my fathers." Jezebel, after hearing of the defeat of the prophets of Baal at Mount Carmel, she rears her ugly head and injects herself. And she had been a polluting influence in Israel and in her husband's dynasty. And now she's determined to do away with Elijah once and for all. And Elijah, though that day he had witnessed God doing what he did at Mount Carmel, Elijah fears for his life and runs. He loses courage and despairs of life. He's alone, he's dejected, and it looks like, in very short order, he's at the end of his rope. Do we see what happened here? Lows can follow highs. I really don't have to define this, do I? Highs and lows. Even think about this expression, depression. Geographically, physically, what is a depression? It's where you got land and then there's a low spot or a hole. We call that a depression. But we understand that it happens in our life, right? And the broad concept of depression, whether you're talking about just at an emotional level or a clinical level or whatever, it is a very broad, complex subject. And this sermon is really not about that. It's just focusing on Elijah, but there are connections here. We understand what it means to be in a low place. As Frank Sinatra sang in one of his songs, "That's life. That's life. That's what all the people say. You're riding high in April, shot down in May." Sometimes it can happen that fast, right? Sure did to Elijah. It can happen financially. Happen with your job or career. It can happen in relationships, friendships, family relationships, marriage relationships. It can happen with your health. We go through highs and lows. And then there is this very mysterious, elusive thing that we call mood. Sometimes we have high moods and low moods. And it's mysterious. Sometimes we can identify why we're down in our mood. And sometimes we can identify why we're up in our mood. And sometimes we can't. Sometimes we'll say to ourselves or somebody else, I'm feeling down and I don't know why. So Rick, there's a line you can put in one of your songs. I'm feeling down and I don't know why. Okay? Depression is a complicated, many-faceted thing. And Elijah is an interesting case study. Because after reading 1 Kings 19, 1-4, how can you not associate the concept of depression or being low with Elijah? It's a demonstration of it, is it not? So what we see here in this situation and with Elijah and what we read about here in the scriptures, we can learn from this about being low. But it's especially true of spiritual lows, which are unique. I mean, it's sort of like a spillover, like you're trying, you've planted a bush in your yard and you want to get it going, and so you water it and you put a sprinkler next to it and you're sprinkling the bush, but guess what happens? That water also goes over to the grass and you water the grass too. So we got sort of a spillover here. Mostly what we see here is the idea of Elijah experiencing a spiritual high and then a spiritual low. But learning about this spills over into any kind of high or low. And I think probably when we go through highs and lows, there's more of a spiritual dimension to them than we realize. Whether in the cause of them or at least in the solution to them. That there's a spiritual dimension. So a spiritual high is where we see God clearly. He's demonstrating who he is. We see an obvious victory on God's part against the forces of evil. And we are even blessed from that. Maybe you're helping someone turn their life around and toward God. And you participate in that and you see that. You're successful yourself in overcoming a temptation. You experience some positive result as you're working in the kingdom of Christ. You receive from somebody a real heavy dose of encouragement and it lifts you up. You participate in an uplifting worship experience. Or you have a period of fellowship with other believers that energizes you. Those are the kinds of spiritual highs that we face. But then they can be followed by spiritual lows. There's an intense temptation that comes after us. Things happen that discourages us. Maybe a person discourages us. There are some disheartening turn of events. Some spiritual disaster in someone's life near you. These things can bring us low. It's what happened to Elijah, and it happens to us. Good to remember that lows are oftentimes followed by highs. So that's hopeful. But it's really the lows that challenge us. There are some unique pitfalls about the highs. But as far as a daily struggle, it's the lows that we are challenged by. And this text helps us. And so we first must understand where the lows come from, their causes, before we can understand the solutions. So let's just look at Elijah as a case study. Because we see that in his case, you don't get any higher than where he was at Mount Carmel. But wow, is he low? He is as the old timers used to say, he's lower than a snake's belly in a wagon rut. He is so low in chapter 19. I want you to consider with me what happens here after this. As he continues to struggle and then God's interaction with him. In 1 Kings chapter 19, verse 4 again, down to verse 18. 19 actually. Verse 4 of chapter 19. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree, and he asked that he might die, saying, "It is enough. Now, O Lord, take my life, for I am no better than my fathers." And he lay down and slept under a broom tree. And behold, an angel touched him and said to him, "Arise and eat." And he looked, and behold, there was at his head a cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water. And he ate and drank and lay down again. And the angel of the Lord came again a second time and touched him and said, "Arise and eat, for the journey is too great for you." And he arose and ate and drank and went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the Mount of God. By the way, that's where Moses received the commandments. It's really Sinai. Verse 9 says, he came to a cave and lodged in it. Remember a few weeks ago, the cave sermon I did? If not, just indulge me, okay? You remember. A lot of people end up in caves in the Old Testament. Elijah's one of them. And isn't it symbolic? And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He said, "I've been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. And I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away." And he said, "Go out and stand on the mount before the Lord." And behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind tore the mountains and broke in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in an earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, the sound of a low whisper. And when Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his cloak and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. And behold, there came a voice to him and said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He said, "I've been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. And I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away." And the Lord said to him, "Go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. And when you arrive, you shall anoint Hazael to be king over Syria. And Jehu, the son of Nimshi, you shall anoint to be king over Israel. And Elisha, the son of Shaphat, of Abel-Meholah, you shall anoint to be prophet in your place. And the one who escapes from the sword of Hazael shall Jehu put to death. And the one who escapes from the sword of Jehu shall Elisha put to death. Yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him." So he departed from there and found Elisha, the son of Shaphat. I want you to look closely at this text at several things that surface regarding the cause of his low point. First of all, self-pity. Note Elijah's self-focus. "I have been very zealous for the Lord. I alone am left. They seek to take my life." When you get all wrapped up into what you're doing and how things are affecting you, and how people are treating you, then something will happen to your spiritual strength. It will drain it. Whenever we start a pity party, Satan is the first one to show up. He loves a pity party. It's his favorite kind of party. And when we think in our head, "Well, I'm this way and I do this, but others don't do this and others don't do that, and I've had this experience and I've had to go through this and this," we got to really watch that. When we think we have it hard or we have it harder than other people, we are actually pushing ourselves down spiritually into a spiritual depression. That's where Elijah was, and that's why he was there. We also see that he has unrealistic expectations. I mean, he lived at a very extreme time when God's manifesting himself in these dramatic ways and all kinds of extreme things are happening. But the fact that Jezebel threatens him, should that have surprised Elijah? Lest we think that what he was facing was a cakewalk, it was not. But isn't that true to form for Jezebel? She's mean and rotten. course she's going to have this reaction. Her boys were the prophets of Baal. And her boys got wiped out. She comes out fighting. Was such an event at Mount Carmel, as grand as it was, remove all opposition to Elijah as a prophet? So no wonder God just rarely does these kinds of things, because even fire falling from heaven and consuming bull, stone, and licking up all the water, even that kind of dramatic exhibit of God's presence and power doesn't automatically turn people toward him. Same thing with the plagues of Egypt and the Red Sea crossing. The Israelites have a front row to all of that, and they get in the wilderness and they start turning against God and rebelling against Moses and doubting and grumbling and everything else. We can't expect the enemy to give up easily. And we never arrive at a point this side of eternity where we don't have to keep fighting evil. I appreciate the songs Ray led, and one of the hymns references about sorrow and grief and disappointment all fading away one day. It will, but it's not yet. We got to keep fighting. And here's a good method for measuring lows. When you find yourself low, spiritually especially, what have I been expecting that I didn't get? Or what did I get that I didn't expect to get? And it's a negative thing. What has happened? I wasn't expecting it to happen that way. It's those expectations. And we got to realize, well, why was I expecting that? Was that reasonable for me to expect that? Or is that about as unreasonable as Jezebel's not going to pull out the fangs and the claws? She's going to pull them out. She loves the fangs and the claws. She's a nasty piece of work. And you think, wow, he's hard on her. Well, read about this woman. She's nasty. Well, you have to be realistic. And when our expectations are not, well, that could be at the root of why we get low. And then there's the idea of loneliness. Did you watch this here, how this text is constructed? In chapter 19, verse 3, when Elijah's running from the threat of Jezebel, we're told in verse 3, he's run to Jezreel, verse 1, and then he leaves his servant at Beersheba. Beersheba's a long way from Mount Carmel. Man, he's making tracks. He goes to Mount Carmel, I don't have a map, but Mount Carmel, Jezreel, Beersheba. And as he goes deeper into the fringes of Israel to get away from Jezebel, he leaves his servant behind. But then when he comes out of this experience, he goes even past Beersheba all the way down to Mount Horeb, which is in the Sinai Peninsula. It's way down in there. When he comes back, verse 19, he departed from there and found Elisha. So this whole incident of his spiritual low is bookended with him leaving his servant and then encountering Elijah, who becomes his assistant for a while. And then when Elijah's taken up to heaven, Elisha takes his place. He's his partner and co-worker. In between, though, where is he? Alone. Hiding in a cave. As we learned a few weeks ago, hiding in a cave doesn't mean you've found some place in the side of a mountain somewhere. Hiding in a cave can happen in here. It happens when we pull from away from others around us. He is mentally and physically alone. And what is he hung up on? I'm the only one serving God. Well, of course, he's the only one he can see. Of course he's thinking I'm the only one serving God because he's all alone. And he doesn't realize, and God has to remind him, he's got 7,000 in Israel who's not worshiping Baal. But Elijah didn't see him, did he? He's alone. Some things we must face alone. But we also must watch about isolating ourselves physically and mentally, because it can drain us and push us down to a low point. We must watch about mentally alienating ourselves, because what we'll start to think is, I'm on an island, I'm the only one experiencing this, I'm the only one trying to do what's right, I, and no wonder we're alone. And we become self-absorbed. You ever, I had this experience lately, you ever be talking to someone and it just naturally comes up and you tell a sad story that's happened to you. And then they tell a story that's similar and it's like, okay, his is a lot worse. His is way more sadder than mine. That happened to me not too long ago with someone. Somebody y'all don't know. And it just reminds us, you know, when you get in that cave thinking, oh me, well, maybe we wouldn't get there if there was more, oh we. And we see that Elijah, this man of great faith and man of great courage. I mean, he stood up to Ahab and he stood up to these prophets. Don't you do that when you read 1 Kings 18? You're like, get him, Elijah. You're just rooting for him. Let him have it, kind of thing. He is some champion. But in chapter 19, you're left scratching your head. He's sort of a sad figure. Elijah felt like he's the only one loyal to God, but God had to remind him, no, you're not. You're not in this alone. When we isolate ourselves or make conclusions solely on our own thinking, then no wonder things are so discouraging. We get inside our own head and we ruminate, and we actually don't see things fully and completely. It's like one of these mornings here in the mountains when you're down in one of the valleys and it's so foggy, and then you get up on one of the hills and everything's clear. You got to work to get out of certain states, because oftentimes in a state of lowness, you're blind. You got to get a better point of view. And that's what this was about, right? God teaching him to have a different point of view. And we see also that lack of goals. Look how the Lord had used Elijah in a mighty way and all that had happened. But here's the point. God's got more things for him to do. Elijah wasn't seeing that. He thought, all this has happened, and I'm no better off than my fathers. Well, his job wasn't over. And it's when he begins to embrace a new set of goals that he moves forward. I mean, there's just that stuff we have to do all the time, you know, wash the dishes and mow the grass. And yeah, that's coming. Mow the grass and do the laundry, put gas, stop and get gas, go back to the store, go back to the store again, go back to the store again. Okay. You ever have to go to the same store like two or three times in one day? I mean, that's just, it's a grind. Serving the Lord's a grind. And we'll never accomplish something so great that then everything's squared away and we can just keep coasting the rest of our life. We'll never be part of something so big that we're not going to have to keep working. And remember that when you head into a spiritual low. Look forward. There's more to do. So how does Elijah get out of this low? How does God help him? And how does God, in a way, pull him out of this low? Now, I want you to consider four things. Food and water. He got physical rest and nourishment. Don't dismiss this. Elijah's worn out. He's gone from Mount Carmel to Jezreel to Beersheba to Mount Horeb. He's exhausted. Whereas the old timer used to say, he's tuckered out. The emotional climax of all day at Mount Carmel, that was draining. And then it says he ran to Jezreel. He physically ran to Jezreel. The adrenaline rush of being threatened. We've all had adrenaline rushes. What if somebody threatens to kill you and they're a queen? That's an adrenaline rush. And then he's dashing into the wilderness. He is drained mentally, spiritually, and physically. What's the first thing that God does for him? Two naps, two snacks. Two naps, two snacks. Two meals and sleep. There's something to that. We are physical beings. God has given us these bodies. These bodies have limitations for rest and nourishment. We need those things. And sometimes things will look better after proper nourishment and some good rest. Before God can even deal with Elijah, before he can start reasoning with Elijah, he's got to get him to rest and eat. The angel tells him, you know, maybe mom and grandma was right. You need to sit down and eat something. Well, no, I'm too upset. No, maybe we do need to sit down and eat something and go take a nap. That's what God does with Elijah. Second of all, and thus the experience coming out of the cave, see that God is still God. He's present and in control. God didn't pack it in at Mount Carmel. He's done. He's gone. He's still there. He's still the powerful God of Mount Carmel. But our God is a subtle God. He doesn't make a lot of noise, usually. He doesn't kick up a lot of dust, typically. On some rare occasions, fire will fall from heaven. The flood in Genesis 6 to 8. The Exodus and the plagues and the Red Sea crossing in the book of Exodus. This incident at Mount Carmel. Jesus calming the storm. I mean, occasionally those kinds of things happen for a purpose. But as is demonstrated here with Elijah, God usually can't be heard in a wind torrent, an earthquake, or a big fire. He has Elijah to step out of the cave to the entrance, and those dramatic, loud, forceful things happen, and he doesn't get a message. He gets a message in a gentle whisper. Typically, God speaks softly. It's like the scriptures. They're just sitting there. We have to pick it up. We have to dive into it. We have to work with it. It's just there waiting for us to listen. It's subtle and quiet. It doesn't jump out and hit us in the face like a Harry Potter movie, some book hits you in the head or something like that. You've got to pursue it and listen to it. There are messages that God is still in charge. Every day the sun comes up. Psalm 19 says it makes its circuit across the sky. That's God's doing. We take it for granted, but that's God's doing. God's still in charge. He's there. But it's easy to miss him when you're distracted with the noise. And there's a lot of noise, a lot of clamor in the world. And there is no better reminder we can give ourselves when we're low than this. God is still there. God has a plan. God eventually always leads us to victory, and his will's going to be done. Those, even to this very advanced, accomplished prophet of God, a man of great faith and courage, those are the things that, in a whisper, God is having to tell Elijah, I still got things to do. I still have a plan. I've got purposes, and my plan's going to happen. I need you to get busy and do it. You see, first Elijah needed to nourish his body, and then he needed to nourish his faith. And you need to nourish your faith. You need to do everything you can do to nourish your faith. Because that's the food and the strength you need to get through and out of the lows. We need the Word of God like we need nourishment from bread and water. And then we see that God has Elijah to get up and do what he says. It's interesting how from chapter 19, verse 19, through the next several chapters, even to the next book, Elijah's around until the book of 2 Kings, the early chapters of it, that we don't really see any more signs of despair. We don't see any more pity language. Party's over. Pity party's over. And Elijah still has some real challenging experiences. But he gets busy in the next round of projects. And it's the best thing for him. And this is part of pulling ourselves out of despair. Because in following what God has us to do, in following his teaching and his instructions, we find meaning, we find worth, we find purpose, we get focus on other things, and it helps us to get out of our head and away from ourselves, and helps us to get out of the lows, the spiritual depressions. Doing what we need to do. And isn't that the problem? It's not knowing what we need to do. It's doing it. Doing what we need to do, even when we don't feel like it, is one of the most crucial decisions you'll ever make and vital actions you'll ever take. I'm going to say it again. This is so true in our service to God, and it's really true in everything. Doing what we need to do, even when we don't feel like it, is one of the most crucial decisions we'll ever make and important steps we'll ever take. The notion of, I just don't feel like it, that is the sorriest excuse we humans have ever come up with. Of course we don't feel like it. But that doesn't have to block us. It doesn't have to chain us down. It's like a vehicle in inertia. That you know how much horsepower it takes to move a vehicle initially from a dead stop? It takes a lot of power for that engine to move that vehicle and get it going. But once that vehicle gets going, it doesn't take as much horsepower. Okay? So this was reinforced recently to me in the last several months. I didn't want a big pickup. I was looking for a pickup. I didn't want a big pickup. But my brother in Florida made me a deal I couldn't refuse. He gave me the deal of a lifetime on a pickup of his, okay? And it's what brothers do, and I've got a great one. And so I'm like, well, I didn't really want a big pickup, but I'll take it because it's a deal I can't pass up. And this baby has a V8 in it. I didn't want an eight-cylinder engine. I'm a tightwad, okay? But then I learned that this truck has this incredible feature. Once you get up and get going, it has a mechanism that automatically dropped from a V8 to a four-cylinder. Because once you get going on the road, now not uphill, but if you're level and you're going, once it gets going, it drops to four-cylinder. It's like you're driving a Corolla. It's great. And it helps with gas mileage. And how can four cylinders move a big old pickup truck? Because of inertia. Once you get going, it's easier to keep going. Just get up and go. Just get up and do what you know you need to do. And you know what you'll find out? It gets easier. If you can just get the movement going and get rolling, it's not as much work to keep it rolling. Elijah needed to get out of that cave. What was the thing he asked Elijah twice? What are you doing here? What are you doing in this cave hiding? Why are you here, Elijah? Elijah's like, oh, this is so bad. And he says, go do this, go do this, go do that. And these are important things. You know why? It's because those two rulers and that next prophet are going to be instrumental in bringing judgment to wicked people, in judgment to wicked nations, and helping the true faithful of God know the will of God. This is a big, important task. Get out of this cave and get at it. Get going. Things would be better and easier. And then fourth of all is the idea of fellowship. Note how that this spiritual low point is when Elijah is alone. He's without his servant, and he doesn't have his new partner yet, Elisha. We come from a culture of rugged individualism, and some people see it as a weakness not to lean on other people. It's not a weakness not to lean on other people, it's a mistake. We need other people when we get low. If we're running low on energy, we got to plug into somebody else's energy. We need them. Recall that at this crucial, trying time for Jesus while he was in his body on the earth, was in the garden, just right before he's taken and arrested, he's got this great, burdensome task ahead of him, dying for the sins of the world and being cursed as a sinner. And what does he do? He takes Peter, James, and John, and he confides in them and leans on them. It's part of how we're made as a human. We need that. And sometimes other people don't really know how badly we need it. I mean, did anybody know where Elijah was and what kind of shape he was in? No. Elijah isolated himself. Now he's running for his life, but that isolation was detrimental. You got to reach out and connect to people, serve people, be interested in people, and there you'll find renewed energy, just like recharging batteries. It doesn't work this way. You don't climb up on top of a mountain somewhere by yourself and cross your arms and cross your legs and say, okay, I'm all up here by myself. Somebody needs to encourage me. It doesn't happen that way. They don't even know where to find you. That's selfish, that's immature, and that's a pouty approach. Don't be pouty. Connect yourself to people. Because this is how it really works. You be a friend to others. You be a brother or a sister to other people. And then when you're a blessing to them, that blessing of brotherhood will come. And when you're low, those relationships that you've worked on, that low you're in, you'll have some help. You'll have some company. But if you don't have those connections, you'll be without that help. And here's a good measurement of that. We all want help when we're in the low, but here's a good question. When you're not low, when you're going along well and even on a spiritual high, who do you connect to and help? Who do you help when you're high spiritually? Because the way that works is then when you're low, that person can help you. Elijah had to get up, get going, and get back with people and get to work with them. And he does. And he's better off. Highs and lows will happen in our lives. Question is, how will we navigate them? How do we get through the lows and come out on the other end stronger? If God helped Elijah, this man whose life was threatened, it was a legitimate threat. But God didn't forget him. And God patiently helped him. And God guided him. And God will see you in that cave. He'll see you in that low. And he'll help you if you but listen to him and let him. Thank you for considering these things. Our brother Ray is going to lead us in a final hymn that also encourages any soul who sees that they are without God, and you realize that you need to come to Christ in obeying the gospel of Jesus, then today you can repent and be baptized and come into Christ and come into his grace and blessings, and Christ will walk with you. If you need to respond, please do so as we stand and sing together.